Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew. And the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's May the 13th, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
Rising of the moon. There beside the singing river, the dark mass of men were seen. Far above their shining weapons on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune.
I'll start off with a few brief comments on the New York City bombing attempt, which I mentioned last week. I'm starting to think that this whole thing might be another 9/11 style setup with a view towards salami slicing a few more of our rights away. It's just turning out to be too pat, too convenient for the authorities, and it's falling into a familiar pattern. A so-called plot, this time with an actual bomb, but one that doesn't go off, so nobody's actually hurt and there aren't any messy, pissed-off relatives of the casualties around to ask uncomfortable questions and bring lawsuits like happened in Oklahoma City and with 9/11. The alleged bomber is caught by brilliant detective work on the part of our magnificent FBI, who, as anyone who's ever had any contact with them in real life knows, are far from brilliant or magnificent. Remember, this is a government who can't, with all their resources, find one man, Osama bin Laden, hiding in a cave somewhere. The FBI are time-serving clock punchers at best who couldn't find the men's room without a wiretap or an informant, and even then they'd have to offer the informant full immunity in the witness protection program. So I always get a little bit suspicious when they pull off some swift, spectacular, and politically convenient arrest. No kidding, you look at their track record and the Bureau simply aren't that good. This latest thing in New York looks really choreographed to me. It turns out that this raghead kid allegedly trained with the Taliban back in Pakistan, but then, according to the regime's official version, he apparently couldn't even assemble a car bomb that worked. Now, granted, the Taliban training program might not be up to West Point or Paris Island standards, but you're not going to tell me that they, of all people, don't know how to make a functioning car bomb. The Muslims are masters of that particular craft, as they've demonstrated over the past 30 years by blowing up tens of thousands of people everywhere from Baghdad to Beirut to Jerusalem. So was this allegedly terrorist-trained Paki kid just dumb? Did he not pay attention in bomb-making class or what? Maybe, but having some training myself from back in the day, I can tell you that building a bomb and learning how to set and operate a timed or radioactivated detonator isn't rocket science. Like everything else, there's a step-by-step drill for it. Yeah, you do have to take a few basic precautions to make sure you don't blow yourself up, but anyone of average intelligence can learn how to do it. If you really want to make something go boom, you can do it. Hell, the mob and Mexican drug cartels do it all the time. Finally, and here's the crux of it, it turns out that this Pakistani kid they've arrested is a U.S. citizen. Now, this is why we need to watch this case, people. It's going to be a precedent setter. The FBI already admit that they interrogated this kid without Mirandizing him, and now the mainstream media are floating trial balloons about trying him in front of some kind of military commission instead of in a civilian court. Okay, he's a brown-skinned Muslim, and so none of us cares what happens to him, but we damn well ought to care. I keep trying to explain to you people that whatever we allow the United States government to do to brown-skinned Muslims, they will eventually do to us. But we seem to have difficulty in wrapping our minds around that because we're so blinded by racial resentment and we're so glad to finally find some brown people we're allowed to hate, at least a little bit. Now, this kid may be a Pakistani, in fact, but he's still technically speaking a U.S. citizen, which is our legal status as well. And if the regime is allowed to set a precedent that any American citizen can be treated like this and deprived of due process, then once that precedent has been set, white people are next. I know we all laughed and nudge-nudge-wink-winked back about 8 years ago when Jugears and Cheney and all their little Jewish friends passed these horrible so-called security laws, because the unspoken agreement we thought we had with those snakes was that these laws would only be used against dark-skinned foreigners of a different religion who flew jet airliners into American skyscrapers, and that they'd never be used against Baptist good old boys with rifle racks in the back of their pickups. Well, surprise, surprise, the United States government lied to us. Jugears and his little Jewish friends lied to us, and all you conservative and Tea Party types need to get that through your buzz-cut noggins. Of course, there's already been one white American arrested and sentenced to 40 years under the Patriot Act, Matt Hale, but that case is so full of holes and so obviously fabricated from the get-go that the establishment has simply buried it along with Hale himself. Another topic I've also been asked to comment on is the nomination of the Batrachian Jewess Elena Kagan to the Supreme Court. By the way, the term Batrachian means that she looks like a frog, which she does. No, I'm not being insulting just because she's a Jew. It's simply a fact. She really does look like a frog. Elena Kagan has got to be one of the ugliest women I've ever seen in my life. She's so ugly, she makes Hillary look good by comparison. I get a lot of questions like this. Harold, what do you think of such and such? Harold, what do you think of so-and-so? And it's almost always some really blatantly anti-white issue where what I think about it should be pretty obvious to anybody who knows me. I know this is how so many so-called great white leaders make their living. They constantly state and restate the problem with never so much as a hint of the solution. Let me ask you guys something. What do you think that I would think about a nigger in the White House nominating a Jewish Marxist lesbian who looks like a frog to the Supreme Court? What do you think my opinion would be? And if you know, why are you asking and why is it necessary for me to comment on something so bloody obvious? Guys, we have to wrap our minds around the concept that resistance against tyranny does not consist of endless complaining about what the tyrant and his assorted agencies and minions are doing. Constant moaning and weeping and wringing our hands over how horrible it all is, that's not resistance. Resistance is something that actually impedes or interferes with what the regime is doing. Better yet, something that actually makes them stop what they're doing. I'm not going to go on and belabor this. Obama and the Jews who run him are stacking the Supreme Court with human garbage in order to totally destroy what little is left of the old normal America. It's long been the goal of the liberal and Jewish left in this country to strip all the last remaining vestiges of power from anyone who's white, male, Christian, conservative, or sexually normal. They appear to be on the verge of success. This Kagan Jewess will be part of a Supreme Court that eventually outlaws gun ownership and legalizes pedophilia and helps to create a one-party state with perpetual Democrat rule once Obama legalizes the 30 million illegal aliens in this country and gets them registered to vote. Now, the Republicans, who are no prizes themselves, remember, are completely unable to stop this Jewess's ascension to the throne because they don't have the numbers to do so. And by the time they can recapture Congress in November, it'll be too late. Now that's democracy for you. It doesn't work. She's only 50 years old, and with the miracles of modern medical science, she could be sitting up there destroying America for the next 40 years. Beautiful. Now, suppose we stop complaining about all this and actually do something about it. While we're on the subject of news commentary, though, I will go into one story I saw the other day on the internet, which is one of the shortest and most grim articles I've ever commented on. The Associated Press tells us that U.S. inflation rose 2% in March compared to the same month a year earlier, according to the Consumer Price Index published on Monday. Now that's it. That's all she wrote, and that's all that needs to be said. That one short sentence should scare the living bejesus out of us. 2% in 1 month? Mother of God! The oncoming train is gathering speed. There was a time in Israel not so long ago when the inflation was so bad that the stores stopped putting price tags on the merchandise because prices were rising so quickly that by the time you got something into your shopping cart and got it to the checkout counter, the price tag wouldn't be valid anymore and the price would have gone up. True, we haven't fallen to the Weimar Republic level when people had to cart their money around in wheelbarrows, and we're not down to Zimbabwe standards yet, where you can carry a $500 million bill in your wallet and it won't buy a loaf of bread. But in this country, 2% monthly inflation is horrendous. That's 24% annually, and in the middle of the Obama Depression, with one person in five out of work and everybody losing their homes to foreclosure, we can't handle that. What do you want to bet that by the end of the summer, we're up to 4 or 5% monthly inflation? And after that, I genuinely shudder to think. We're probably looking eventually at $10 per gallon gas or more, $15 per box of hamburger helper, and $250 for a pair of cheap plastic shoes at a Walmart. This is in a time of 20% real unemployment. Now here's what's happening. Remember those trillions of dollars of TARP and stimulus and bailout money that Barack Hussein Obama and his little Jewish friends over at the Federal Reserve printed up a month after he was immaculated in January 2009? Ben Bernanke may not even have gone to the trouble of running off all the actual bills on the printing presses. He may just have clicked a few computer function keys. The one then proceeded to pay off his 2008 campaign debts, including truckloads of federal funding to Akron, and I'm sure he found some way to slip $500 million back to George Soros under the table. But then he loaded up the banks and the stockbrokers, the mortgage companies and the international financiers with trillions of dollars worth of newly printed money. Now, the banks then used this to pay off each other's paper, batting it all over back and forth like a badminton bird, since for years they've been staying afloat by borrowing money from each other. The accumulated interest soared higher and higher and eventually pushed the banks into paper bankruptcy. Now, all of this, of course, was accelerated by the subprime mortgage crisis, wherein millions of blacks and illegal aliens were given mortgages at ridiculous interest rates, which they then defaulted on after a couple of payments. Then, legitimate white mortgage holders started losing their jobs, mostly outsourced to India and China and Guatemala, and they couldn't pay their mortgages either. But now, that artificially created Federal Reserve money from a year ago is starting to seep down into the real economy, and economic nature is taking its course. A larger money supply means that everyone has to charge more in order to get the same value for goods and services. Now, more simply put, the larger the money supply, the higher the price of everything. When a government responds to deficits by simply printing more money instead of raising taxes or cutting spending, you get Zimbabwe-style runaway inflation where people are carrying around $500 million bills in their pockets and they can't even feed themselves. All of this is economics 101, of course. Obongo probably doesn't understand it, but Bernanke and Rahm Emanuel and David Axelrod and Cass Sunstein most certainly do. So why the hell are they doing it? It has to be deliberate. Now, these Jews in power are deliberately destroying this country's economy so that they can impose a Marxist socialist state. That far, at least, Rush Limbaugh's got it right. Okay, time for our first music break. Now, some of you responded to my comments of several weeks ago regarding the Spanish Civil War and the Siege of the Alcazar and my playing of the phalangist anthem Cara al Sol by asking me to play more historic Aryan music from the 1930s era, especially German marches. I can do that, but we really should start off with the Horst Wessel lead, and I haven't been able to find a version on the net that I like so far, so we need to look around a bit more at the musical heritage of that time. I have to admit, I've never been much of a Mussolini fan. People think that because Italy was allied with Germany during the war that Mussolini and Hitler were the same kind of leader, but that's not true. Mussolini was anti-communist, but that's only because in his youth he was a communist and they threw him out. Mussolini was not particularly racial in his outlook, nor was he even anti-Jewish, except towards the end of his life when he saw what the Jews were doing to Europe and to Italy in particular. But many of Mussolini's fascists were brave and interesting men, such as the novelist and adventurer Gabriele D'Annunzio, and the Black Shirts did have a few good songs. Now, if there ever was an Italian fascist equivalent of the Horst Wessel song of Germany, this would be it. It's called Giovinezza, the Song of Youth. Thank you.
henne lite hare till valorte sai guerrieri la virtù dei pionieri la vittoria la ricchieri oggi brilla il tutto in cuor
gloria
Last week, half in jest, I played a song which I referred to as male chauvinist instead of racist, and let's face it, it was, wasn't it? I also explained why I was playing that particular song, or at least in what relation to racial and cultural politics I was playing it. I half expected a huge negative response from all our female comrades out there, but only one contacted me and told me that it bothered her. Still, that one is one too many, so let me get a little bit more into this whole male-female thing, which is actually one of the most important issues that any white revolutionary movement needs to address. If I had to pick the absolute worst thing that the Jews have ever done to us, I would say that they have driven a now almost insurmountable wedge between white men and white women. Nowhere else is the clearly genocidal and anti-human nature of Judaism more apparent. Nothing else has caused more suffering, anguish, disruption to Western civilization, or loss to the world's Aryan gene pool than the creation of a society where white men and women view one another as adversaries instead of partners. There's an old Norse saying, "All that is evil springs from the corruption of women." I can't put it any better than that. The instigation and propagation of this hatred between white men and women is the Jews' greatest success story. Possibly in the long run, a greater victory for Zionism than the destruction of the Third Reich or the creation of the criminal state of Israel. Because when white men and women hate one another, the number of white babies born drops like a stone, and we get closer and closer to that point of no return where our racial extinction becomes inevitable. And always bear in mind that is the ultimate goal of the Jewish people, to exterminate every man and every woman with a white skin from the face of the earth. Like religion, this can be a very divisive and upsetting topic, but it is important and we need to talk about it. Unlike religion, this problem is solvable if we can somehow reacquire the art of thinking instead of feeling. Also, unlike religion, it must be thrashed out and solved now, not put aside for the time after the revolution when we have power. Some time ago, I wrote an article on this topic called Vive la Difference, and I was asked at the time where that famous expression came from. I understand it happened like this. Back in the 1890s, France was considering giving women the vote, and some famous French feminist, whose name I can't recall, was given the honor, almost unique for a woman at that time, of addressing the National Assembly in full session, all male, of course. The legislators all sat there, attired in their full formal dress suits with the top hats and the white gloves and wide shoulder sashes, decorations, spats, and other such 1890s politicians' fripperies. The lady was up on the podium, haranguing them with her feminist rap, and they all listened in polite silence. She concluded her speech with, "Really, messieurs, you must acknowledge that when one comes right down to it, there is very little difference between women and men." And at this remark, the entire French Chamber of Deputies spontaneously rose to its feet as one man and shouted out, "Vive la différence!" And that pretty much pegs it. Men and women are different. Not inherently inferior or superior to one another, but different. To say that one sex is in any way inferior or superior to another is like saying that apples are inferior to oranges or vice versa. They're two different fruits, and any such comments are a matter of personal taste and outlook, not scientific or pragmatic fact. To say that an apple is in some way better or worse than an orange has no relevance or meaning in the real world. One is an apple and one is an orange, period. The differences between men and women are, in my opinion, about 20% environmental and psychological, and that 20% can in some circumstances be subject to a certain limited degree of possible manipulation and alteration, but by no means as much as feminists would like to have us believe. About 80% of the difference between the genders is biological, physical, and biochemical. It's therefore pointless and absurd to try and create in men and women two equal humanoid organisms. It can't be done. Men, on the whole, are physically larger and stronger than women. Yes, there are individual exceptions. More so in today's politically correct culture as white males degenerate into Dilbert-esque cubicle dwellers, and women become more masculine in character, which seems to somewhat augment their physical size. Or maybe that's just the fatty American diet. One of the most sinister developments in recent years has been several statistical surveys and studies indicating that sedentary American white males are actually losing their virility in the physical as well as the moral sense. White sperm counts have been dropping for almost 20 years. We are becoming less than men in every sense of the word. But as in all non-yuppie, more or less organic societies of all races, men, as a rule, are the larger and stronger. Now, some of this has to do with diet. In any business or work environment where there are large numbers of illegal aliens, for example, compare the size of Orientals who were born and raised in China or Southeast Asia on nothing but rice and little fish with the size and weight of Asian Americans who were born here and grew up on plenty of fruits, grains, vegetables, and good old-fashioned cholesterol-packed red meat. Native-born Chinese women especially are tiny things between 70 and 80 pounds, although they're actually stronger than white valley girls due to having been forced into manual labor from birth. Men are naturally larger and stronger and more aggressive than women because nature has given human men and women a natural division of labor, a division of labor that is cast in genetic concrete and that cannot be repealed by feminism, by affirmative action, or by anything else. That natural division is simple. The man provides the food, the shelter, and the protection from enemies for the family unit. The woman bears and raises the children. This is how human beings are supposed to live. Indeed, it's the only way they can live past a couple of confused and chaotic generations of the kind we're experiencing now. It is innate. It is biological. It cannot be changed, and any attempt to tamper with it produces disaster and destruction, as we are learning now in politically correct America. No baby creatures are more helpless than human infants. Snakes and alligators are self-sufficient from the time they hatch. Birds and kittens and puppies are up and functioning and providing their own food in a matter of weeks. But human babies must be fed initially by a mother's milk for a period of months and then on specially treated and prepared food for another couple of years or so. They can't defend themselves or escape from an enemy without help. Human children can't really live on their own without any hope of survival for the first 8 or 10 years of life. The whole traditional nuclear family that is so hated and railed at by liberals and feminists is an institution ordained by God or the gods or nature or the force or the great pumpkin or whatever to make sure that the human species continues to exist. The primary purpose of the man-woman relationship is not to fulfill them or expand their consciousnesses or anything like that. The primary function of the whole man-woman thing is to produce children and care for them until they are adult enough to fend for themselves. All the romance and the courtship and the love and the poetry and the drama and the whole history of men and women is incredible and glorious and fascinating and all that, but it all boils down to that one central function: having babies and raising them until they're old enough to have babies of their own. the emotional and cultural side benefits to traditional marriage and the nuclear family unit are certainly valuable and have produced our whole civilization, but they are, in fact, incidental byproducts of the central process of continuing the human species. The father and the mother are not the most vital part of the picture, although they're essential. It's not about them, it's about the children. Now, this arrangement is not unknown in other species, and in all mammals, at any rate, the male is always larger, stronger, faster, and more combative. In many cases, such as lions and wolves, one alpha male practices polygamy with a number of females and kills off other male competitors until he grows old and weak, and in turn he's killed off by a younger male. Primitive non-white societies in Africa and the Third World still follow this pattern. Now, Aryans, for the most part, have generally mated for life down through the years. There are some records of polygamy in ancient Aryan cultures, but not as many as elsewhere. The ancient Norse and Germans practiced it, but gave it up about the turn of the last millennium. For good or for ill, once the Aryan race became Christianized, polygamy vanished. Now, no comments about Mormons, please. They're not typical, and their polygamy is not organically rooted in history, but in conscious chosen behavior. One reason for polygamy was extremely high male mortality rates in time of war. An interesting modern example from the Muslim world is Saddam Hussein, who awarded large cash bonuses, automobiles, and homes to Iraqi officers who took a widow from the Iranian or American wars as their second or third wife. The Iraqi gene pool has been decimated by the slaughter of almost 30 years of continuous warfare, and Saddam was quite open about his determination to ensure that Iraq was not depopulated. I wish to hell Germany had created some kind of similar kind of polygamy status after both world wars. Men and women are two halves of a whole. They neither can or should exist without the other. The idea of two halves of the same organism competing with one another, dominating one another, or existing in antagonism with one another is an obvious recipe for destruction. This is why the Jews promote the idea that white men are some kind of natural enemy to white women, as they promote any and all things which are destructive and poisonous and breed confusion and unhappiness among our people. They hate us and they want us all dead, and they use every weapon they can to bring this about, including feminism. Quite simple, really. If you'll permit me a quick digression here, homosexuality is another weapon the Jews use to prevent white babies from being born. It's a loathsome perversion. It's absolutely and utterly wrong because it denies the natural division of labor between man and woman and because it precludes the production of children. The instinctive loathing that the overwhelming majority of normal people feel even today for faggots and dykes is an inner recognition on the part of our genetic makeup, or souls if you're Christian, that what's going on is unnatural and counter-survival, or sinful. This is why politically correct brainwashing and social engineering, which has been relatively successful in obtaining a grudging acceptance of mud people as equals, seems largely to have floundered when trying mentally and emotionally to coerce people into accepting the open practice of sodomy. This is especially true when it involves a sodomitic threat to children. Whites are still capable of anger and action when the local school board tries to bring in Heather Has Two Mommies. Seems to me that forced sodomy is about the only thing left that white people will react to. Millions of years of genetic codes triggering biological survival behavior can't be overwritten by 50 years of Hollywood propaganda or suppressed by hate speech laws. In the Northwest Republic, we intend to recreate a world based on natural order, and that most specifically includes, as it did in Germany, a return to what is referred to as the traditional family and traditional family values. With the gainfully employed father as the head of the family and the full-time mother and homemaker as the family's heart. I got into this a little bit in The Hill of the Ravens. This does not in any way involve enslaving women. In the very real sense, it liberates them from feminism and Judaic values and the true slavery of the economic marketplace. Women today don't have careers, they have jobs, and I'm sure they have found out the hard way that it's not the same thing. The women of the future Northwest Republic will have a freedom which they have all but lost today, the freedom to be real women. What largely Jewish and lesbian feminists want, claim, or advocate is not relevant to anything in the real world. They, more than liberals as a whole, are doomed to eventual defeat and disappointment, however much they may have achieved a very temporary and very slight superficial success in the English-speaking world anyway. Now, bear in mind, feminism is almost unknown in the Third World or anywhere outside the Western world, i.e. the white world. Apparently, white people are the only ones who are stupid enough to fall for it. Feminism is essentially a form of sexual perversion because it distorts what is natural in the sexual roles of men and women. Feminism, like integration and all forms of liberalism, can only be imposed on both men and women at the point of a gun, literally or economically. Remove the force of Zog's law and the economic necessity for women to work simply to make ends meet, and feminism will die a natural death. Speaking of women, time for our second music break. This is one of those voices that makes one remember that there is indeed a God. This is Lorena McKennitt singing the Bonnie Swans.
Yeah.
You know, that song is actually a modernized version of one of the oldest known ballads in English called The Cruel Sister. Down through the years, I've heard all kinds of versions and variations on that, from medieval songs to Appalachian mountain ballads. And as part of my self-appointed project of teaching white people about their heritage and their culture through music, I may see if I can dig up a few more versions of that piece on the net and play them here. Occasionally, I get questions from racial nationalist women of various tendencies about abortion, some of whom still haven't quite shaken off a lot of their feminist conditioning from politically correct society. I found this one in the files. Dear Harold, I certainly feel that the need to repopulate the Republic and our race is paramount, but I must admit that I have a serious problem with not having a say as to how my reproductive system will be used. I know, I have the option of not getting pregnant in the first place, but there are so many other complications that can happen. There's also the possibility of rape or incest or what have you. To simply say that the child will be born is ludicrous. The wording in the Northwest Constitution is so, shall I say, Christian. It just smacks of dogma. No, thank you. I know that in life shit happens, and I or my daughters should not and will not pay the price for the practices of people today. If a woman or young lady in this new republic should find herself in trouble by an unsavory sperm donor, we should have options. Not to say that we shouldn't be a little bit more careful in our actions, but man has been dictating what women will and won't do for too long, and I am, for one, not going to go back down that road. Please don't mistake my words for that of a feminist. It's just that we are a lot more valuable to this cause than just breeding stock. Well, I never claimed that you were just breeding stock, but never mind. Okay, the issue here, I think, is somewhat wider than the constitutional prohibition against abortion in our Northwest Constitution, but let me address that first. Of course, you should bear in mind that I'm not talking about abortion as it's practiced today, but we're speaking of our own idealized future. There's a lot of hell we're going to have to go through before we come to that particular bridge, but our draft constitution is an attempt to give us at least some kind of roadmap as to how we will cross such bridges when we do come to them. Any attempt to create a basis for a new order, as opposed to a new world order, must necessarily consist of a lot of locking the barn door after the horse has already been stolen, i.e. to try and make sure that whatever errors our descendants may make in the future, we at least don't make the same mistakes and commit the same abuses that are daily events under the United States. Let's start with the basic facts. Aborting a fetus is the murder of a human infant. You are killing a human being, and the stage of development of that human being is immaterial. If you can kill a child 2 or 3 or however many months prior to birth, what exactly is the difference between sticking a pistol into the crib and shooting a 2 or 3 month old baby? I'm simply damned if I can see any. This isn't a matter of ideology or the race of an infant or whatever. It's simply a matter of fact, of logic. You're killing a human child. And lest I should be accused of being sentimental, I have to say in all candor that I'm not particularly worried about non-white fetuses getting aborted, since that's fewer non-white adults we'll have to deal with. But it's still killing a human child, and I acknowledge that fact. Now, I'm familiar with all the medical mumbo-jumbo slapped together by the abortionists to try and prove that an unborn child is some kind of inhuman piece of tissue that can be removed like an appendix or a gallbladder, and it's simply drivel, flat-earth stuff. I don't know what else to say. This is just me, but how anyone cannot understand this is beyond my comprehension. It's like asserting that the sun rises in the west. It's just not true. Now, this being the case, and it is the case, I have to assert that at least as far as white people are concerned, we are human beings, not rats or hamsters or spiders. We don't eat our young. This idea that all sexual matters are private is liberal horse manure, along with the non-existent right to privacy, which 9 black-robed pigs created out of nothing in the present Constitution, and which you will notice is significant by its absence from our own. Yes, certain matters having to do with sex and sexual behavior are matters for the community as a whole and for the law. It's always been like that, and only the wildest of Jewish and liberal academics have claimed otherwise, with their push to legitimize all consensual sexual behaviors, regardless of race, gender, age, or species. How does one get consent from a sheep, anyway? Prohibiting abortion has nothing to do with men controlling women's bodies or reproductive systems. It has nothing to do with misogyny or some deep, dark male conspiracy to control women. It has to do with who we are as divinely created beings with souls. It is a matter of bringing to an end an unspeakable practice which common sense should tell us that no civilized society can possibly tolerate for any length of time without suffering permanent and irreparable biological, demographic, cultural, and spiritual damage leading eventually to destruction. Now, if this offends or pisses anybody off, so be it. I understand that in my present position, I have to be very careful, and in some cases, on some subjects, I have to do a bit of a high wire act so the NF and the migration can get square one someday. But there is such a thing as throwing out the baby with the bathwater, pardon the expression. No abortion in the Republic is one of those things regarding which we simply cannot ever consider any kind of compromise. It's bedrock, like the no non-whites and no homosexuality principles. If we're going to compromise with evil to that degree, then what in hell are we doing any of this for? Before we leave the topic, though, I need to point out that this isn't just a couple of racist guys making up something in a constitution for a country that doesn't exist yet, except in the hearts and minds of a few people. We do actually have a working model to follow to offer women who might be interested an alternative, and there is one. It's the old National Socialist Lebensborn program. No, put away the comic books and the silly paperbacks with the garish swastika covers. That was not some kind of secret Nazi program for breeding a master race. What Lebensborn was an attempt to deal with the fact that a lot of young German soldiers on leave were taking the train to the Eastern Front and never coming home, and leaving behind a lot of young German girls, married and unmarried in the family way, and for various reasons unable to care for or raise their children. Since it was by no means uncommon in those days for Papa to be killed at Stalingrad and Mama to be killed in the latest bombing raid on Cologne, there were also a hell of a lot of orphaned children and infants to be cared for. Young pregnant women, married or unmarried, were recognized not as shameful hussies, but as a valuable state resource to be nurtured and treasured, although I realize that's going to sound almost as bad to feminists as the other. They were offered the full backing and resources of the Reich. The Lebensborn homes to this day dot Germany and Austria, some of them having quietly converted to private clinics of various kinds when the invaders marched in. The girls were offered a home, food, safety from the American and British bombs, medical care, including skilled midwives, and a supportive environment in which to have their babies. Afterwards, it was up to the mother and the family what to do. If, for any reason, the mother was unable or unwilling to care for the child, then the baby was placed with a foster family who, in many cases, had already lost someone at the front or in the bombing, and were more than happy to gain another child to soften the blow and bring back some joy and fulfillment in their lives. Lebensborn was one of the most underreported of the Reich's success stories. To this day, there are elderly men and women throughout Germany who grew up in Lebensborn homes. Okay, no doubt some of these adoptions were less than perfect, especially given the circumstances of the time. No system is perfect or fail-safe. But I'll tell you what the Reich didn't do. They didn't rip the bloody infants from their mother's womb and toss them in the dumpster out back of the clinic, as happens every day throughout the American Empire. That is a large part of what the Northwest constitutional exercise of ours is. For the first time ever, back in 2006, the movement actually came together in some kind of thoughtful discourse on the subject of exactly what we want, what kind of world we want to make when we win, and what we will replace the present corrupt system with. That's very important, but right now it's just an exercise. Before it becomes reality, the world is going to have to change, and the white man is going to have to change. I have to say this yet again because it is vital to our understanding of the world around us. This world that we have to change. One of the main weapons that the Jews have used to destroy Western society is to turn white women against white men, to create an adversarial relationship where there was never one before and where there should be none. For instance, you will note that, among other unpleasant characteristics, any time a racist or neo-Nazi is portrayed in the movies or in books, they're always misogynists of some kind as well, rapists or wife-beaters or child-beaters or guys who cheat on their wives, anything the Hollywood producers and screenwriters can come up with to portray racially aware white males as bad mates, bad husbands, bad fathers, unfit sexual partners, etc., etc. In other words, racially aware white males are portrayed by the media and in Judeo-liberal social engineering as bad life choices. The object is clearly to frighten white women away from choosing such partners and to punish racially conscious white men by denying them marriage, family, and normal heterosexual relationships with women of their own race, while simultaneously encouraging interracial sex with every means at the command of their media and social engineering arsenal. The objective is to deny opponents of the present regime the right or even the ability to reproduce. Libs and Jews even have a term for this, although they still to this day keep their voices low when they say it. They call it eliminating racism by eliminating race. Another word for it is genocide. To quote a low-end but highly effective and common example, how many times have we seen in comics and detective magazines, etc., and now video games, images of SS men in jackboots and swastika armbands flogging nude or semi-nude busty babes in alleged concentration camps or Gestapo headquarters and so forth? How often have we seen Ku Klux Klansmen portrayed as lusting and leering after well-stacked niggerettes or country white women? Time for another one of Harold's movie analogies. One example that springs to mind is that god-awful piece of toxic waste called the Shadow Riders, where after the Civil War, an alleged group of renegade Confederate soldiers kidnap a group of white women and try to sell them to brothels in Mexico in order to raise money to finance a new Confederacy. Now, two brothers, Tom Selleck and Sam Elliott, who fought on opposite sides during the war, unite to rescue the women from the evil, leering slave masters with Confederate flags and Southern accents. Sam Elliott, the ex-Confederate, nobly redeems himself from his wicked rebel ways by fighting against his former comrades in gray. I have never been able to get even halfway through this wretched flick without running to the bathroom and puking. Okay, we see every day on the tube how the Jews want white women to think about white men, and guys, it works. It's working a treat up until this very day. I used to have a joke that when my email went dead, the one sure way that I could get you guys to wake up and start posting like mad to whatever forum I was running at the time was to either open up the floor to religion as a topic, so the Christians and the anti-Christians could scream abuse at one another, or else I would rerun a single article I found somewhere on the net called The Allure of Marriage, which would immediately get all our male comrades and our growing number of female readers as well out and shouting their rage and their hatred at members of the opposite sex and their own race. There are a lot of divorces and broken relationships among us, just like there are among the white population as a whole, and just about everyone has a fund of bitter stories they're anxious to blast all over cyberspace. Now, just as we have those among us who hate white people of different religious views worse than they hate the racial enemy, so I have occasionally detected people in our ranks of both sexes whose main problem seems to be with the other gender. 50 years of Jewish social engineering is nothing to laugh off, guys. We see it every day on our TV screens, and it pushes our buttons. It pushes mine. I recently attempted to watch a movie version of The Ring of the Nibelungen, and I turned it off the very second I saw a busty blonde with a sword in her hand and an armored steel bikini. Now, me being a history buff, I find that Xena warrior princess horseshit especially offensive. Okay, now for our third music break, which isn't really a music break. It's not music as such, anyway. But this will at least get us off the battle of the sexes for a bit. I got a fair amount of listener response from the last few podcasts about theme songs and characters from the Northwest novels. Now, many of you sent in some suggestions, and I'll see what I can do about playing them for you in future shows. You may recall that in two of the novels, The Hill of the Ravens and The Brigade, I quoted a lengthy excerpt from the Shakespearean play Henry V. This is the spoken version of those lines from what is probably the best movie version of the play. Sometimes people ask me what it is that I really want out of all this, and one way I might reply is that someday I want us to be able to speak like this to our descendants and for it to be true. This is Kenneth Branagh.
This day is called the Feast of Crispian. He that outlives this day and comes safe home will stand at tiptoe when this day is named. And rouse him at the name of Crispian. He that shall see this day and live old age will yearly, on the vigil, feast his neighbors and say, tomorrow is St. Crispin's. Then will he strip his sleeve and show his scars and say, these wounds I had on Crispin's day. Old men forget, yet all shall be forgot, but he'll remember with advantages what feats he did that day. Then shall our names, familiar in their mouths as household words, Harry the King, Bedford and Exeter, Warwick and Talbot, Salisbury and Gloucester, be in their flowing cups freshly remembered. This story shall the good man teach his son, and Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. We few, we happy few, we band of brothers,
For he today that sheds his blood with me shall be my brother. Be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in England, now abed, shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhood's cheek, whilst any speaks that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day!
Okay, let me wind up on the man-woman thing. I don't want to sound like I'm beating it to death, and I really hadn't intended to spend this much time on it during this podcast, but like I said, this is important. We need to see if it's possible to actually talk things out like sensible adults with a problem instead of reacting emotionally and starting lifelong vendettas over some mild word of disagreement. I never try this with religion because that problem is insoluble. This one is soluble, given goodwill, a sense of urgency, and a few brain cells to rub together. If ever we need to find some way to resolve an issue so we can move on to fighting the enemy on common ground, this is it. So can we use these few nuggets of wisdom as a starting point? White women, I'm talking to you now. Feminism is just as Jewish as communism ever was. White men are not your enemies. There is no vast male conspiracy to do you down or keep you barefoot and pregnant in chains or deny you $100,000 a year jobs or whatever. We love you, goddammit, and we can't understand why you do some of the things you seem to do deliberately to hurt us. You want to know how a real man feels about women? Read Shakespeare's sonnets to his Dark Lady. Read Abelard's letters to Heloise. Read Dante's immortal epics to Beatrice, a girl from his childhood that he barely knew and probably never even spoke more than a few dozen words to in his life before she married someone else and then died young. And yet he loved her so much that he spent the rest of his own life giving her immortality for the ages. If you want to know more about how I feel on this issue, read my Northwest novels. There are true warrior women in all four. White men, your turn now. There is nothing weak or wimpy or unmasculine about respecting, protecting, and cherishing women. That's the way our race did it or tried to do it for thousands of years. Only a cowardly dog strikes a woman under any circumstances. Men who hit women do it because they're not man enough to fight other men. One kind of man that I will never knowingly allow to participate in the NF is a woman beater, because that indicates that something is so badly twisted and wrong in that man's mind that he doesn't have what it takes to be a political soldier. I think it's significant that this one character I've had hanging around for almost 20 years now trying to sabotage everything I became involved in is a notorious woman beater. Now, if he'd been booted out by certain fearless leaders 2 decades ago, a lot of problems would have been avoided. Also, us guys need to understand that many women have a complaint against us, which is very valid. We need to grow up. We need to understand that adolescence does not last forever, despite what we see on TV and out of Hollywood. Life is not one long spring break. Life is not one endless round of snowboarding, beer drinking, playing with high-tech toys, and endless sexual encounters with beach babes without responsibility or consequences. Man up and shoulder your responsibilities, both in a family way and in a political way. Guys, gals, the Jews have screwed us both over. Now let's get together and return the favor. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sascha Undenbahn. Freedom. Follow in their footsteps, the rising of the